Hello and welcome to another episode of the Challenger City TO podcast. I'm your host again, Ian Montgomery, and today I've got a great guest. He's a fellow conspirator, sometimes collaborator. We've worked together on a lot of things. He's called Rami Nassar. He runs a little agency called 1000 Days Out, and kind of the clues in the title, they are great at doing foresight, futurism, keynote speaking, really helping people think about what the future will look like. Now, Rami brings a ton of knowledge across emerging tech, things like AI, quantum computing, and he spends most of his time thinking about how that's going to impact the future of companies, organizations, sometimes cities. But really what he's great for is recognizing it's not all about technology, and instead how we must understand the core problems in designing for a better tomorrow. So without further ado, let's jump into a great conversation with Rami Nassar and enjoy the episode. Rami, thank you so much for joining me today as like the next person I've sort of dragged into this Challenger City thing. We've worked together a lot, and I think most people who know me know that we've worked together a lot. So we can be pretty open and honest with each other. And I can do you a great intro about how you're a fantastic foresight person, you're a great consultant, you're an excellent keynote speaker for people to book. But it's always nicer for people to introduce themselves in their own words. So let's get this thing started by just having you like share a little bit with the listeners about who you are, what you do, why you do it.
Cool. My name is Rami. My favorite movie is Back to the Future. I've always wished I could, and Back to the Future 2 in particular, I've always just wanted to go to the future, less interested in traveling to the past. And I think I'm not joking and I'm not being silly when I say that's kind of what inspires me in my work in foresight. Is foresight is our toolkit for thinking about the future and shaping the future to be what we want it to be and not having it shaped for us, whether that's at the human individual level, the organizational level, or the system, government, city level. And so you can't these days think about the future without thinking about the role of technology. So I spent a lot of my time thinking about the impact of artificial intelligence for today, we'll call it AI, going forward on all of us, on our systems, on our tools, on our economies. But I am actually spending, I'm actually getting pretty tired of AI. I've been speaking on stages publicly about AI for the better part of a decade now, since way before ChatGPT made it cool. And I'm actually spending more of my time lately thinking about quantum computing and other emerging technologies and how those over the next 5-10 years are going to impact all of us, regardless of the people out there who say we won't ever have our own quantum computer. So I'm actually not convinced of that. So long and short of it is, I'm a mostly professional speaker and workshop facilitator who thinks about the future and tries to help organizations do the same.
So when I said I was doing this thing around making Toronto a Challenger City, what do you actually think of when we say Challenger City? What does that really mean to you?
So I should admit, I don't live in Toronto, but I have lived off and on in Toronto throughout my life, most recently up until 2017. But I live in Kitchener-Waterloo, and I'm typically in Toronto at least once a month, whether that's overnight or just day trips for client work or presentations. When I think of Challenger City, and Ian, maybe it's just part of the day job, I automatically think of Challenger Banks, because you and I have worked with various banks and Challenger Banks within it. But this notion of just working and thinking differently. And I think Toronto has tried a couple of times and others have tried a couple of times, but fundamentally, I don't think a whole lot has changed. I know there's an office of data or AI now. I think that is odd and nonsensical to me, because I think ultimately the notion of challenge is to do things differently and to just follow the trend of where technology is going and do what everyone else does. And technology isn't a challenger mindset. I would say when I hear the word Challenger City, I get hopeful and optimistic for a place that is more livable, more affordable, just better to be in. And sorry for the fans, but I don't think Toronto has been going in that direction for the last while that I can remember.
Why not? What stands out to you as to where Toronto is going in the wrong direction?
I mean, certainly affordability for many, many people is a problem. And that's not unique to Toronto. That's a problem facing most Canadian cities. I'm fortunate enough to travel a lot internationally. And every time I do, whatever city in the world I happen to be in, when it's not in Canada, if I'm in a downtown and I walk past a real estate office where they got those lit up little pictures of the houses and apartments for sale or rent in that city. Every time I'm blown away and I look, I'm like, oh, it's not crazy here. It's not crazy here. And yet I did that in Canmore, Alberta last week, and holy cow, is it crazy there. And I know it's a tourist hotspot and these are vacation rentals that are for sale there, but they are insane. I shouldn't be able to buy a newly renovated 8-bedroom castle in France for less money than a 2-bedroom condo in Canmore. It just doesn't make sense. So I'd say affordability is one, and that is a at least amplified right now in Canada, but a problem in many places, especially housing affordability, but then all aspects of affordability. We wouldn't talk about groceries right now. I would say moving around the city. Yes, there is the TTC and it works. I would say the highest compliment I could play to our transit infrastructure in Canada. And I'm also thinking about the GO train between Kitchener-Waterloo and Toronto. The highest compliment I can think of is it mostly works. It's not pleasant. It's not fast. It's not reliable, but it mostly works. And again, you don't have to go too far outside of our country or continent to see places where it really works, where it works well, where it's convenient, where people make choices that are better and don't just widen highways. And I'm thinking about cycling. I happen to be a fairly active / obsessive cyclist. And I know that in Copenhagen, where it's not much warmer than it is here in the winter, 49% of commutes are done by bike. 49% of commutes are done by bike. In Toronto, it was estimated to be a little under 3%. So there's individual choice, there's infrastructure, there's technology, there's a whole bunch of factors that play into that. But moving around cities, I find to be harder and harder. Getting in and out of the cities, harder. Ian, you know, I like having dinner with you. When was the last time that I agreed to drive to Toronto to have dinner with you? If I'm going to have dinner with you, it's because I'm there for the day and it's easier for me to stay a few more hours than to drive back sometime, anytime between 3 and 8 p.m.
We agreed to have coffee a few months ago and you set off from Kitchener about 6 in the morning and by 9:30, you still hadn't even made it to Toronto.
I was late for a workshop that day. Yes. And again, I don't want to just like say traffic sucks. It sucks everywhere. But I would say just even within the city, moving around is hard. Pedestrian deaths, cyclist deaths, things like that. So that's another thing that I think could be better. One thing that I will say about Toronto is that makes me happy is, especially in the summer, if you want to go out and do stuff with your family, aside from getting there and the cost of it, there is a lot of cool stuff going on. Weekend festivals and things like that, certainly more than we have in Kitchener-Waterloo, although we're getting better here too. It is a smaller city. So I do think that's good. I think that I'd love to see a world where it's not just the summers for that kind of stuff, that it's through the year. And I see more of that in Europe where families go out and do that sort of thing all year round and we brave the cold and we don't hibernate. But I do think that's one of the really positive things that Toronto and some other big cities have going right now.
Do you think Toronto's a lost cause? Do you think it can be fixed? Do you think it can be made better? Or is it what, like, I feel like we're in this point where like lots of people go, oh, it's this sucks, that sucks, we could never do this because X, Y, Z. And then you got a lot of other people trying to make it better and sometimes trying to copy European things and apply them here and doesn't quite work because it doesn't fit the context. But like, can Toronto get good at this stuff? Or is it just like, this is just the way it is, man?
No, I don't think I'd even be spending the hour with you talking right now if I felt it was a lost cause. I actually think, and I realize I just referenced Copenhagen, I might mention Paris too, as very bikeable cities. I know there are differences between these places. I actually think it is problematic when cities try to be the something of something else. The Silicon, at one point, Toronto and Waterloo or both together tried to claim to be Silicon Valley North. And it made me like viscerally angry because yes, there's a lot of cool tech stuff happening in Silicon Valley. And there's a reason it developed there. And you got to go all the way back to like early like HP days and things like that. But there's a lot of shitty things about that part of the US too.
Yeah.
I didn't ask you in advance if I could swear. So I'm sorry if I've offended anyone who's listening. But the being the something of somewhere else, I don't like that. I think there's a lot of potential in being inspired by what others do, but then being your own. However, I also think that being insular and just not looking around at what is going well is even more problematic. I'll give you the example that made me like really angry. And it was back a couple of years ago when the Toronto Raptors were a good team. And I think it was associated with Raptors, but I could be wrong. But there were these t-shirts that everyone in Toronto wore that said Toronto versus everybody. And I'm not a violent person, but it made me want to like hit that person, because this idea that somehow being the center of the universe, center of the world, we're not. Toronto isn't. Nowhere should be. But if anywhere was, I don't think it'd be Toronto. So I think it's a balancing act between wanting to have your own city cultural identity and being inspired and learning from cases where others. But I don't think the answer is just to copy other cities, because every city will have its own challenges. You just don't always see them. And when you're a tourist, like if you go to, I don't know, Munich or Paris or wherever, Barcelona, as a tourist, as a visitor, even as a business traveler, you're going to be enamored by it. And you're going to see just the good stuff. You won't see the pain points that city has, right? So I think it's risky to just take the learn from others approach alone. That was a long answer. Sorry.
No, it's a great answer. And do you know the thing that will make you even more angry is that those versus everybody t-shirts were actually, I think they originated in Detroit around about the time Detroit went bankrupt. So it's not even a thing Toronto invented. It's a thing Toronto saw and somebody else had and copied it.
That actually makes it worse somehow, because there was at least something interesting about it being a uniquely Toronto thing, but the fact that it wasn't even original.
It's very Toronto. It's like, we'll have this thing where we're the center of the universe, but we borrowed the idea from the others being the center of the universe from somewhere else that actually went through something way worse than what we went through. So yeah, I can totally, whenever I see those things, I'm like, oh, you just look like a jerk wearing that. It just sucks. Unless you're from Detroit, in which case everybody really was against you at one point. So like, I find it is an interesting answer. Like, there's this thing of like, we look elsewhere, like we all go on holiday, we all travel for work, and we'll go somewhere and be like, oh my God, it was so nice sitting outside there. I find, especially if you go to Europe and the Middle East, like you go to a city and everybody's outside in the evening, walking around, having a coffee, like kids are playing like right splat downtown in the middle of a city. And it's lovely. And then people come home and immediately it's like, well, the kids can't play in the street because it's too dangerous. But we could never not stop using our cars and make the streets safe for our kids. So it's like, how do you fight through that kind of challenge of the, it's a slightly hypocritical mindset of, we know we can have nicer things, but we almost stop ourselves from having nicer things. I think that's the big piece for Toronto to get over. But at least you think we can do it.
Yeah. And I remember sitting with you, I don't know, 8 months ago in Austria, right? And we commented about exactly that. Like, here's one, you know, as an example, maybe to illustrate what you just mentioned there. And this comes from when I did live in Toronto. It's probably changed since then, but I remember when Kensington Market had proposed pedestrian-free Sundays. Oh, sorry, not pedestrian-free, car-free Sundays, aka pedestrian-friendly Sundays. And borderline uprising, and eventually, at least this a few years ago, they settled on one Sunday a month, because God forbid that a small little market area one day a week, just for the summer, by the way, would shut down and not allow cars through. Which, by the way, if you've driven through Kensington Market, it's not a particularly easy, convenient, or even nice drive. There are a million pedestrians there anyway. It's not really made for driving through. But the attitude of, no, we could never do this, was very strong, and people fight it. And so, yeah, it does just, I guess it makes me sad a bit. This is very depressing, Ian. You said I was going to feel good after this.
I know. There's a TVO documentary called The Life-Size City, and I think episode one of season one is set in Toronto. And they literally go to Kensington Market, and I think this must have been like 2017 or something. But they call out exactly that thing of Kensington Market says, like, street close to cars on some days. It doesn't say which days or whatever, but it's like it's again that like maddening thing. But either way, we're going negative, we're going to go positive. I want to flip it a little bit, because you do talk about AI a lot, and you said in your introduction that you're kind of tired of talking about AI. Whether this is AI, technology, just greater computing power, like, do you think that is that the sort of holy grail savior solution to cities like Toronto to make them better?
Oh, God, no. Sorry, was there more to that question? Otherwise, it's a very just a simple closed no answer. No, I would say AI is a piece of technology that the global we is quite enamored with right now. But ultimately, it's just a new way of programming computers. That's all it is. That is not rules-based. And it's showing to have a lot of power and potential and do things. But I think the idea of it saving us is a dangerous and terrifying premise.
The reason I ask it is I see this a lot of, you know, I like an argument with a man who complains about car congestion getting into downtown Toronto. And I feel like we go through this every other week. That's sort of along the same lines of, oh, AI for better design of streets and traffic signals and the congestion will go away. And I know it's bullshit. And I will swear on this podcast. So, and I won't apologize it like you, you nice Canadian. Why do people get hung up on this idea that AI is the solution when, like, clearly you've been talking about this for a long time of, like, it's just a new way of programming computers. That doesn't fix the problem for us.
I mean, let's be specific then. Think about that example you just shared, improving traffic congestion. I think it can probably improve and reduce congestion on some roads. But no matter how much you optimize, and then we were talking about optimization here, there is a functional limit of how many cars can get through a certain amount of physical space in a certain amount of time. There's just a limit, like a mechanical, physical limit to this. So I think this idea of it saving us is dangerous. But I also think the part that's dangerous about it is our problem with traffic that our roads aren't optimized, or is our problem with traffic, and so I sound like a bit of a hippie here, that people choose to get in their car when there are other ways that they could be getting around, right? So I would be much more inclined to be thinking about, are we even solving the right problem? I got nothing against using AI to optimize traffic. We should 100% do that. It's great. It'll save time and money for people, but I don't think that it's necessarily getting to what the problem is. That's the part that worries me.
I think it's interesting. We know the symptoms sometimes, but we don't necessarily know the problem that we're trying to solve. So we see the congestion, we see an overflowing bin, we see homelessness, crime in the street, we see pollution, we see people not coming to the office because it takes them such a long time, but we don't necessarily see we're seeing symptoms, not problems, and then we're being reactive to that rather than like getting down to what is the actual thing that makes a great city and why do we not have it?
Yeah, I have nothing to add to that. I agree.
I finally found an opportunity where you're not having an argument. This is good. So in terms of like when you look at it, like now having, you've lived in Toronto, you've moved, like you've lived in Kitchener for a while now, like as this outsider, like what's your take on it? Like what would you, if someone put you in power in Toronto for a week, what would you change?
Well, that's tough because I don't think the challenges you and I are talking about can necessarily be changed or fixed or tackled even in a week. I think they're systemic, but I think it sucks when people like me, no offense, talk about problems without talking about solutions, and it's kind of what we're doing. I don't know what the solution is to our crazy housing crisis. I think very few things that people talk about, I think, will have the positive impact that's being sought. But I think we've gotten ourselves into a bit of a mess in terms of having affordability costs in Canada, because you can't roll it back. The only way to make things suddenly more affordable is to make essentially everyone who's bought a house in the last few years suddenly, quote, poor, right? To say everyone's house is worth half as much. We're just going to hit reset on this. Not the way it works, right? It's a one-way street. And so if there was something I could tackle, I think it'd be trying to figure out, can we make it more desirable to move around in something that's not a car? Like in many parts of the world, car wouldn't be the default way of going. And I think our mindset is car by default. And maybe for a special reason, we do something else, aside from people who can't afford the car. Is there a world where the car becomes the last resort? Because that's what it is in many cities in Europe, in the Middle East, and other places where walking, biking, transit, things like that, those are the first of the options. And you would only get your car. And my family, we became a one-car family, maybe about a year, year and a half ago. And yeah, there are definitely times where it's a pain. There are times where my wife needs to drive our little guy to preschool and I have a meeting in Toronto. I take the GO train. It's not great, but I would do that. There are sacrifices to be made. I guess maybe I'll share one other thing with you, but it's going to be a rant. I don't know how to fix it. There's a fundamental, I don't want to say this nicely, lack of understanding of economics and scarcity. And what I mean by that is I heard a very lovely sounding woman on the CBC the other day being interviewed about a similar long Bloor wanting to basically go from four lanes of traffic to three. and adding bike lanes. Cool if you're against it, cool if you're for it. I would be for it. Many would be against it. What made me frustrated and want to shake people was when this person was interviewed and said, yes, I think we should add more bike lanes, but I'm not willing to do that if we have to give anything else up. It's not how anything in this world works. It's the have your cake and eat it too, right? To think that I'm supportive of cyclists as long as I can still drive my car as fast as I want and need to, sadly just doesn't work. Physically, I don't know where this person expected those bike lanes to go if there are not fewer traffic lanes. But even just on a systemic level, thinking, I want this, but I won't give up that. Climate change, traffic, affordability, all these things, we will all have to make trade-offs. That is the fundamental principle of economics. It is a study of scarcity. We have scarce resources. And I think everyone kind of just getting that would make me happy, because I think we would then be willing to have those conversations about the trade-offs. Because right now, politicians are stuck because they cannot safely, as in safely for their job, say something to their constituents that involves a trade-off. They have to offer both things. And that's just not how it works.
Steve, hit something for that's been stuck in my head for a while. And I use the example of Hyde Park because I live near it. But about a year ago, they tried to close the park to cars because it's a park. What I sort of struggle with is they didn't then go, well, we're going to do this with the road space. It was just like, well, cars can't come in on weekends. We'll try and like limit how cars go around during the week. And it felt like a sort of, how do we compromise in a way that nobody is really worse off, but no one is particularly better off? Like, we haven't necessarily thought through, like, we'd rather have a 3 or 4% benefit at no loss rather than to anybody, rather than say, right, a few people are going to lose out, but lots of people are going to have a much greater benefit. And I think this is the, you're touching on it there with the bike lane example, also on Bloor. I live near there, so great, more bike lanes, please. But I think that's the thing that gets lost, is we're so scared to make a decision that there will be a loud voice of somebody who doesn't get to do what they used to do, even if that doesn't mean lots of people can do a new thing that's better that they couldn't previously do. And until we can get over that, we never solve the problem.
And we're more scared of taking a position and a stance than ever before because of technology, internet, AI, social media, probably some combination thereof, and the ability to manipulate what someone said to the point of, you know, nonsensicalness, like, so-and-so is against car traffic. They want to take your cars away. No, they don't. They just think that if we made room for bikes, fewer people would use their cars. Because biking in Toronto is terrifying. I've done more than my share of it. It can be terrifying. If we make it safer and more accessible for people, we actually might not need that much space for cars. That's the premise of it. But you can't say that without being accused of being a car hater. Look at, it's an extreme example, but look at right-wing politics in the U.S. Oh, the Democrats want to take away your gas stoves. No, they don't. They just don't. They've acknowledged, we all have learned, turns out running a gas stove in your house is basically like smoking cigarettes in your house. I have a gas stove. I'm not going to replace it till I need to, but I'm more aware of it now. But all of a sudden, some science, some logic and reason comes out, and there are messages that say Democrats want to take away your gas stoves. They want to take away your right to eat hamburgers. No, they don't. So this the spin machine and the amplification and fake things, fake news, whatever you want to call it, on social media, I wouldn't be a politician these days. I see zero appeal to it. I've been asked to run for various positions. I'm like, why would someone want to do this other than to satisfy their ego? Because it's a hard to win kind of thing these days.
It's often with, like, it's a game of arguments rather than a game of solving problems. I saw something really nice the other day that was saying, we always try and sell things like cycling on their eco-credential or on their, it's like you're being pious by riding a bike. Whereas we don't necessarily sell these things based upon the another benefit that might be more about a sin. So the person was using this example of wine on the bottle says only 65 calories a serving. And it's actually just playing to your gluttony or your greed in a way of like, oh, I can have more wine than I otherwise would have had because it's low calories. And like, I've found it weird that no one's ever really tried to sell public transit or cycling as people will find you more attractive if you don't drive a car and you take the train. You will turn up at your meeting more well-read and more knowledgeable because you've had time to sit and read a book in comfort and air conditioning or heating or whatever it might be. You'll be fitter because you've ridden a bike. Like the auto industry does an amazing job of selling cars kind of based upon like what's sort of sexy and slightly sinful, but we're not necessarily competing on it based upon being like, how do you make cars really ugly and how do you make the better choices like look and sound sexier and better for you?
If you live in a city in the downtown, let's say, or quasi downtown area in Toronto, for the most part, if you just applied logical reasoning, you wouldn't drive a car. Cycling gets you exercise, causes little to no pollution, probably gets you there faster, depending on how far you're going, and saves you money because you do not pay for gas or electricity, save e-bikes, or parking. It's actually like when you do the pro-con chart of it, there are no pros to being in a car for the most part. And if you could get maybe, you could maybe argue safety, maybe, I don't know. I don't have the stats on that, but if we made it safer for cyclists and more accessible, you could knock that from the con into the pro con too. But you're right. We don't market it that way. We don't think about it that way, right? To make it appealing. But there is very little rational reason to drive a car instead of riding a bike or walking or taking transit. Again, especially if you're in a downtown city. That's one of the few things I do miss about Toronto. I did bike everywhere. It was quite rare for me to get into my car, which I did own, but it was pretty rare for me to get in my car if I was going anywhere in the city. Exceedingly rare, I would say, because I thought about it's just all pros. My legal pad with a pro con chart is one side.
I think it's seriously joyful riding a bike in certain cities. And if it's a city with some hills, an e-bike, lots of bike shares have e-bikes. Toronto has loads of them now. They're great when you can find one that's got charge on it. And if you know where you're going as well, it can sometimes be a bit stressful on a bike. If you don't quite know the directions or where to turn, you can feel a bit nervous. But if you've been there once and you do it again on a bike, it's just such a nicer way of experiencing a city. But we don't seem to sell cycling like that.
I left that off of my pro list because I also think maybe that's just you and I. I think cycling is more pleasant than being in a car, even on a hot day, even on a bit of rain day. But I know not everyone would think that for some, it might be a chore. It might be. And now the whole physical taxing thing, e-bikes have solved for that. So you can't even really make that argument anymore. But I left the joy of cycling out because my own bias is I cycle typically between 250 kilometers a week. I don't think that's even a good argument to be made. But yeah, for a whole lot of people, it should actually be a more pleasant experience. Like nothing makes me happier when I see cars and I pass them in the bike lane safely. And look back a couple of blocks later, I'm like, oh, you're stuck three lights back. I'm like, I'm getting exercise. I'm outside. This is nice. I'm saving money. And it's faster. It's wild. And I have a two-year-old who works well on the front or back of my bike. It can work as a family too. The arguments about, you know, saying you have kids, you can't put a two-month-old on it. I get it. There are certain limitations there, but for most age kids, still works. Now we're just having a chat about cycling, though. So
I know. I want to take you in a different direction, though. So like in a lot of the work that you and I have done together, it's often with a big traditional stodgy company exploring something new. The people we work with day to day are really excited about it, but they have to then go and make that case to their boss or to other teams who might be a little bit more like, well, we can never do that, or we've done it this way for ages, or actually, that's not in the five-year plan. And we spend a lot of our time trying to help those clients convince their own people that this new thing is the right thing to do. How does the city go about doing that? I don't expect us to have the perfect answers because I don't know, and I do this for a living with companies, and so do you. But how can cities do this better?
I think there are good answers for that one, actually, because it's actually a lot of what I spend my time doing now, not at the municipal city level, but more corporate, which is, that is the job of foresight. Foresight, to me, above most other things, is about identifying often weak signals and trends that are pointing us to a different looking future, where we can see that signal and say, hey, if this thing continues and we have data and reason to believe it will, the world will look different in the future. Let's design for that future and not for the present. So I'll give you an example I've been thinking about a lot lately. I'm going to tell you the term I'm going to give you now. I'm not going to say I coined it because I don't know that no one else did, but I've never heard it from anyone else before. So as far as I'm concerned, I coined it, but it's quite unlikely that I'm the first person to use the term.
Plant your flag, man. Own it.
So we're familiar with digital natives, that term, and that's not the term I'm talking about here. The generation of people entering the workforce who basically grew up with some form of the internet or World Wide Web mostly at their disposal, right? Whether that's through smartphones, computers at younger ages, but basically all of the world's knowledge kind of available to them. That generation is now well into the workforce. What I'm fascinated by the last literally couple of days here is thinking about this notion of AI natives, a new generation that will be entering the workforce in the next 2 to 5 years, for whom access to kind of chat-based AI interaction tools will be the normal, whether you call them kind of Copilot tools, not the Microsoft Copilot, but that mindset around Copilot, working with AI as a tool to help you do your day-to-day stuff. And the reason I think that this is happening is I teach at a few different universities, and I think out of sheer desperation for not being able to fight against this force by the universities in terms of academic integrity, and they did try to fight it at the beginning by just saying you can't use these tools to write your essays, most policies now are saying, with the professor's permission, you can use these, and here are our citation guidelines. So some universities I teach at have formal guidelines on how to cite ChatGPT or other large language models when you use them as part of your work. Again, it does require the professor's permission, but generally speaking, they are now allowed to use these tools in their work. So they're going to come out of university or college and whatever training, expecting companies and organizations to work for where they can work that way. So we actually have data that shows us that this generation of AI natives will be entering the workforce. So rather than employers thinking about how do we block access to these tools or do we investigate pilots, they should be thinking about how do we get ready for an entire workforce to becoming a current generation to be coming in, expecting these tools to work for them and with them. That's foresight. That's looking at what the future world will look like and leaning into it and preparing today for the world of tomorrow. And I think cities, above all other types of organizations, have a responsibility to that. So we shouldn't look at, if you go back to cycling, well, how many cyclists used this bike lane last year? Not enough to justify widening it or making another one. No, what's been the trend? What direction is that going in? What are the costs of gas looking like? What are car insurance costs looking like? What other factors might tell us that in the world of tomorrow, more people might choose cycling? And we might want to invest now in that infrastructure, because God knows it takes us forever when it comes to things like consultation and design feasibility and studies to do things like put in a bike lane. So foresight is our tool for identifying those weak, often needle in a haystack sometimes, signals that might get amplified, and then preparing for the world where those futures come true. I was ready for that question.
I really thought you were going to bring up McKinsey's thing in New York with that.
I try to reference McKinsey as little as possible in my life. No offense to anyone who works for a consultancy.
As we should not offend people who work in consultancies, but try and think about McKinsey as little as possible. But as you talk about that, like, I think of the, I assume you've seen it was in the news this week, of New York City spent $4 million on a McKinsey report as to whether they should put garbage in bins, and if they put garbage in these container bins, what would that mean for the city? It's an important piece of thinking. Absolutely should be done. Probably should have been done a long time ago. Probably shouldn't cost $4 million. But I think like what you're getting at there is that there's these sort of basic things that we should be thinking about into the future. But the way we sell, like, we shouldn't necessarily be relying on this is me projecting here, but we shouldn't be relying on a big expensive consulting report to make that case. Cities should be able to do that themselves. That should be an innate skill to think about the future, basically.
Agreed. I've got not a whole lot to add to that, and then saying, yeah, that's terrifying. I didn't know about that $4 million report. I mean, hooray for the partner of McKinsey who put $500,000 into her or his pocket out of that. But yeah, that's terrifying.
It's available on the internet. I encourage people to have a look at it and see what $4 million gets you in terms of consultancy in 2023, 2024. But there you are. Rami, as I get to the end of these things, I really like to round them off on, if people had a magic wand, I know I said like if you're in charge for a week, I meant more if you just had a week to set the world straight. But if you had a magic wand when it came to making Toronto a challenger city, what would you do? What would you want to make happen with that magic wand?
You know what? I think what I would want to do is I would travel back in time to when Google had their whole idea around Sidewalk Labs, be in a position here of some sort of influence, whether within the city or within Google, and have a go at getting that right. Because I think what they ultimately wanted to do, and forget about the data side of Google, wanting to collect everything, that we can park that dilemma for a moment, what they ultimately wanted to do was try something different. See, can we develop part of the city differently? Unfortunately, they said, it all starts with technology. I think the way to start would be, let's start with, like you said, right, the root cause problems. What do citizens and visitors want out of their city and work from that? But if I had a magic wand, I would say, you know, I don't know the numbers, but I'm guessing tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars that they did invest into it could have probably been used better and could have led to something kind of cool in that part of the city. I think that's what I would do. Or more bike lanes.
You know what I think is most interesting from this conversation is when we started, you started with my favorite movies, Back to the Future 2, and I wanted to go to the future, and that's why I do a lot of the work that I do. One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is you're one of the best people I know talking about future technology, AI, the impact of that. And where we end it is you want to go back to the past, work with a technology company, and make it not all about the technology to have some sort of more livable, fun, like optimistic, positive vision for an opportunity that we've missed. And I just think that's a really nice way of packaging an episode that we've done here, which is so much more focused around like this idea of foresight, thinking about the future, having a vision, and then doing the things so we can test and learn to see what works and then building on it from there. Like, maybe it's because I've worked with you a lot, but I feel like that sort of rounded out a conversation really, really nicely. So thank you.
Yeah. And I think I've been tricked because I said I want to go in the future and you got me to somehow say that I want to go back into the past at the end. But
that's why the movie's called Back to the Future, Remy.
It's also my 2-year-old son's one of his favorite books. We have several different kids' books around Back to the Future. And although he calls them Marty Fast Car Book, because there's the tires with the fire coming out. So it's called Marty Fast Car Book, but we know that means Back to the Future. So thanks, Ian. This has been fun.
Well, not only have you trained your child very, very well, but I think he might have a future as somebody who rips off famous old movies and allows his dad to re-script them as different franchises. So maybe there's a future career in that for you and him.
Oh no, he's going to be a Tour de France like this. He wakes up every morning saying bike race, bike race, bike race, and he watches with me at 7 a.m. So his future is already spelled out, but thank you for the suggestion.
Well, hopefully we can go to the future and find out.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Ian.
Thanks, Remy. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Challenger City TO podcast. You can find written up versions of all these interviews, as well as a history of the other podcasts we've done to date, if you go to challengercityto.substack.com. We'll see you again for another episode very soon. Thanks. Bye-bye.